These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. They are produced by the Teaching Company. The Great Courses cover a broad array of university-level disciplines. The lectures in each course are either 30 or 45 minutes long. By listening for less than an hour a day, you can finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalog or website and imagine how much you could learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the best college classrooms in the world. The lecturers are university professors, carefully selected by the teaching company and its customers for intellectual distinction and teaching excellence. The lectures on these tapes are titled Natural Law and Human Nature, Part 1. The lecturer is Father Joseph Katursky. Father Katursky is a member of the Society of Jesus and is an associate professor of philosophy at Fordham University, where he specializes in the history of medieval philosophy and natural law ethics. Father Katursky received an HAB in classics from Xavier University and earned his doctorate in philosophy from St. Louis University. Ordained as a priest in 1992, he earned his Master's of Divinity and License of Sacred Theology from the Weston School of Theology in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Prior to taking his position at Fordham University, Father Katursky taught at the Center for Thomistic Studies at the University of St. Thomas in Houston. While at Fordham, he has been recognized for his teaching skills. In 1998, he received the Dean's Award for Outstanding Undergraduate Teaching and the Graduate Teacher of the Year Award in 2000. In addition to his teaching, Father Katursky is a prolific writer and currently serves as editor-in-chief of the International Philosophical Quarterly. Father Katursky prepared the course guide that comes with these tapes. The course guide includes a detailed outline of each lecture, a glossary, a timeline, biographical notes, and bibliography. To get the most out of this course, you may find it useful to follow along with the outlines or review them before or after each lecture. Lecture 1, The Philosophical Approach.
Our study of natural law ethics in this course intends to reflect upon a very ancient and venerable tradition in the consideration of morality. It is a study that involves the consideration of ethics as it's been known since the time of the Greeks, through the Middle Ages and into the modern period and to our own day. It's a study of one important strand of ethics that goes by various names. I'll be entitling it natural law, but you also see it under such terms as the higher law, an unwritten but nonetheless superior law which stands over any piece of jurisprudence that any particular community, any kind of custom that any human culture has ever devised, and asks about the justice of those customs and the justice of those laws. It's called a higher law. Sometimes it's referred to under the tradition of natural rights. Sometimes one finds it being talked about in terms of human dignity, and these are just a few of its names. In order to try to make clear what this tradition is right here at the start, what I'd like to do is to begin with three important cases that bring out this notion of a higher law or a natural law, and then reflect for just a little bit on the importance of considering our topic philosophically. And then finally, I'll say a few words about the general nature of this whole course and the parts that the course will take. But let me begin with calling upon an ancient story from Greece in the classical period. The wonderful play by Sophocles called The Antigone. You may well know that story. It's the story of the town of Thebes, which has been rent by a civil war, on which opposite sides two brothers have fought, Polynices and Eteocles. Both have been killed in the course of the war. They are brothers to the heroine of the play. Their sister's name is Antigone, and she gives the play its name. And she finds herself in that predicament of having family loyalties to both brothers. But the king has decided that only the brother who supported the side that won, that has supported the administration of the city, should be buried and buried with honor. Whereas Antigone's other brother will be left to rot in the fields, as a kind of dishonor, precisely in order to discourage rebels from raising arms against their city. It's an understandable position that Creon would have to maintain order and will stand for the maintenance of that system of justice which he is charged with considering and charged with maintaining in the course of his administration. But Antigone feels a very strong loyalty to her brothers, and she cannot imagine leaving her brother to rot. She finds that her obligation is an obligation that takes her counter to the civil law, to the law that Creon has enacted, which forbade her brother to be buried, but which calls upon a higher law, calls upon a law which is invoked by Zeus. Let me read a short portion of the relevant text. Creon is speaking. "You tell me not at length, but in a word, you knew the order not to do this thing?" And Antigone says, "I knew, of course I knew. The word was plain." Creon then says, "And still you dared to overstep these laws?" Antigone, "For me, it was not Zeus who made that order, nor did that justice who lives with the gods below mark out such laws to hold among mankind. Nor did I think your orders were so strong that you, a mortal man, could overrun the gods' unwritten and unfailing laws. Not now, nor yesterday. They always live, and no one knows their origin in time." Now, one finds in that short passage of a very interesting play all the important themes of natural law, which will eventually be articulated by philosophers in the course of history. We start, in the first thing that she says, with an admission that this has been a voluntary action on her part. She has gone and buried her brother, thrown dust upon the corpse, so that the soul will now rest in peace. And she has done so knowing that this transgressed the law which the king had made. Hence we find that scenario, which is so common in the history of natural law, that a law that is higher and unwritten is being invoked against the law that was laid down by the authority in the community. Creon is the authority in the community, and there's every sense that he has a legitimate authority, that he bears his power correctly, and in fact that he has given a command here, namely that the corpse of a traitor should not be buried, given a command which is quite reasonable, a command which is clear, a directive which requires that its citizens do something which makes good sense for the common good of the community. Her appeal is to a higher source. It's interesting how she does it. Again, to read just the relevant line. "For me, it was not Zeus who made that order, nor did that justice who lives with the gods below mark out such laws to hold among mankind." She is invoking a higher source. She calls this higher source Zeus, but she also calls it justice. And one has a sense that this is not just an appeal to some specific command that the Greek god Zeus ever gave. We could look in the various stories of the mythology, and we will not find a particular command to that effect. But rather, this is a very philosophical kind of Zeus. This is a sense of using the word, the name Zeus, and linking it with the very notion of justice as justice personified, that this is what justice requires that I do for my brother. In fact, later in the play, in a passage that is somewhat complicated, the scholars debate over whether or not it is the original rendering or a later change that was made in the manuscript, she even makes the case that it is not simply because it is her brother lying there, but that anyone who died should be given proper rites of burial. And if that second reading of the text is accurate, this would invoke that very strong natural law theme of the universality of natural law, that it is something that applies to every human being, regardless of our particular kinship relations with them. It's also a sense in Antigone's speech that this is a higher law, because she contrasts it very strongly and immediately with the law that Creon has laid down. She does not dispute his authority in general. He is, as the leader of the city, perfectly justified in making laws that give directives that we sometimes dislike. But rather, what she finds is that the particular directive he has given violates justice, that it transgresses this higher law. And hence, she invokes a higher law against a law laid down by a human ruler, and urges that morality requires her to do what she did, even if it will cost her, and indeed it does cost her her life. As the play goes on, she is shut up in a cave, and Creon leaves her to starve to death. There's an interesting romantic element because she has been a fiancé of Creon's own son. He rushes to try to find her, but too late. It is one of the great tragedies of the period. And it begins some of that reflection upon natural law that the Greek period knew. Let me turn to a second great story, because it also gives an important sense of the way in which natural law has been present, not just in the period of antiquity, but is present in our own modern jurisprudence. One of the interesting factors, I think, of this whole course will be the tremendous recurrence of the natural law, that it comes again and again in every age. The incident I mean to mention for the second story are the Nuremberg trials, that in the history of our own century just past, one found a scenario where natural law, not under that name, but under one of its synonyms, had to be invoked in order to solve a problem in modern jurisprudence, namely the fact of a government, the Nazi government, which did actions and laid down as policies, which in fact enacted legislation, which after the war was prosecuted in the city of Nuremberg. The judges at the trials of Nuremberg found themselves at the very start of the proceedings with a very difficult legal problem, namely, that even though they were British or American or French or Russian jurists, that they could not try German officers or members of the German government under British, American, French, or Russian laws, because what had been done not in any of their jurisdictions. And yet here they were set up as the trial court to examine certain of the deeds of Nazi Germany. They found that they could not use German law, because although the people who were now being accused of these crimes were indeed German citizens and had done their deeds on German soil, they had done them in perfect legality, according to German law. For part of the story of the Nazi period is the care with which the Nazi movement made sure to bring the deeds that it intended to do under legal jurisdiction by enacting appropriate legislation. So you couldn't use the law of the victors, and you couldn't use the law of the vanquished. What could you use? What the members of that court decided to do was to prosecute the people who were brought before its tribunal under the term crimes against humanity. And there we see another one of those synonyms for natural law. I suspect they did not use the term natural law because natural law has a checkered history. We will, in fact, see in the course of these lectures, when we turn to some of the historical instances of natural law, that natural law theory has sometimes been used, and I dare say abused, for ideological purposes. In fact, a part of the Nazi period was an attempt to justify the repudiation of tribes, of races other than the Aryan race, under natural grounds, suggesting that there was a superiority to the Aryan race by nature. And hence you did not want to now try them under natural law, or at least to be using that term, if it in any way suggested an acceptance of what the Nazis had done. But the natural law idea is never confined to that particular terminology. Sometimes it will be human dignity, sometimes it will be natural rights, sometimes it will be human rights, although for most of its history it's been called natural law. Here, these justices required a term that would speak to the consciences of the world about what it is they were doing, and they settled upon crimes against humanity for the sake of the trials that they needed to conduct. Post-war Germany also felt the importance of what the Nuremberg trials had done, and in the effort to reestablish a system of justice and good jurisprudence in Germany after the war, one finds German basic law and the jurisprudential tradition within Germany making use of this natural law idea. Let me again read a short portion that comes from some of the jurisprudence that was elicited after the war. Quote, "These laws of confiscation," this is a passage that deals with the return of property that had been taken unfairly during the war, "these laws of confiscation, though clothed in the formal rules of law, are an extremely grave violation of the suprapositive principle of equality before the law, as well as of the suprapositive guarantee of any legal order which must remain inviolable. These provisions were and are, by reason of their unjust content and their violation of the basic demands of any legal order, null and void. This law could not, even at and during the time of the Nazi regime, produce any legitimate legal effect. Unquote. That passage from 1955 is a very interesting instance of natural law reasoning. It suggests the importance of a law that is somehow higher than the laws which were used during the Nazi period and whose validity and legality were now being commented upon. This reference to a justice that stands higher than the laws that were actually in force makes that same contrast between what the formal rules of law were and what the justice that any code of law must embody always has to insist upon. Here, the insistence upon a just order and a just content manifests that same sense of a moral tradition, and it brings up this need for judicial review. Judicial review is one of the terms that we will be invoking again and again in the course of our lecture, and it refers to the employment by the court of a standard by which to judge the legality and the justice of legislation. Our own American Supreme Court has a doctrine of judicial review, which operates in a somewhat similar manner. We'll have a chance to examine later in one of the lectures to about the extent to which it uses a natural law standard. Here, there's a very interesting bit of terminology that I want to call your attention to. It talks about suprapositive principle of equality and a suprapositive guarantee of any legal order. And that is terminology with which we must be familiar right from the beginning of this course. Positive here is not being used in the sense of the contrast between positive and negative. Rather, positive is being used in the technical legal sense of a law which has been posited, or a law which has been laid down by human authority. In this sense, a constitution, as well as administrative laws, as well as the legislation that is passed by a particular Congress or a particular legislature, all of these are positive law because they've been laid down by a human authority. And what the German court is referring to in this 1955 opinion is the notion of a suprapositive standard, that is, some principle which stands above anything that has been laid down by human authority. A suggestion that whatever the human authority lays down or posits for the sake of procedure or for the sake of some substantive principle of law, there are higher principles yet, principles which are above anything that has ever been positive, principles that are eternally true, true because of what we are, our human nature, true perhaps because God laid them down, but for whatever source they come, they are true and they are superpositive, or they stand above the legislation that comes from human authority. In this sense, the German court is invoking the natural law tradition without having to call the thing by that particular name. Let me now turn to a third example that comes from our own American history and that cuts very deep to our hearts, I think. It is the case of civil rights and the enormous progress that has been made in the civil rights movement, especially in the course of the 20th century. I'd like to refer to the case of Martin Luther King in particular. In his letter from the Birmingham jail, a very famous document, he also makes use of this natural law tradition in order to protest against racial prejudice. And here we see a third important scenario, because we have not just the actual state of existing laws against which he was protesting, but he's also protesting against a custom which was a very long standing here on these shores. And so in the course of making his analysis, he is invoking the natural law not just against a particular decree, as in the case of Creon, or a system of law, as in the case of the Nazis, but managing to use natural law to examine human custom as well, and hence I think this is a very important third representative case. Let me quote from Martin Luther King. He says, "A just law is a man-made code that squares with the moral law or the law of God. An unjust law is a code that is out of harmony with the moral law. To put it in the terms of St. Thomas Aquinas, an unjust law is a human law that is not rooted in eternal law and natural law. Now, in that passage, we find Martin Luther King invoking Thomas Aquinas. And Thomas Aquinas is a figure whom we will see again and again in the course of these lectures. In the whole history of philosophy, he is probably the most famous proponent of natural law. He does it in a rather brief compass within a treatise on theology that he wrote. But in the course of doing so, he manages to state with great precision what these principles are and to put the thing in a systematic compass. Martin Luther King, knowing of this tradition, invokes him as an authority, but does so largely to emphasize to us that one can do this from the point of view of morality considered in secular society, the kind of instance that Martin Luther King must consider because of the jurisprudence in this country, or it may be done in a religious tradition, not just the traditions of ancient Greece, where we had that reference to Zeus in the first passage that I read, but now reference to the God that Christianity accepts, the God of Jesus Christ, which Thomas Aquinas had reflected upon in such great detail, and which Martin Luther King believes in. And Martin Luther King, invoking the tradition in this way, urges us to say one can do this philosophically as well as can do it theologically. I'll be trying to make use of those themes in the course of our lectures, this particular course, trying to talk about its theological roots as well as its strictly philosophical roots. Now, mindful of this recent history of ours, Martin Luther King, it's good to reflect that Martin Luther King didn't invent the idea. Martin Luther King wasn't the first to apply natural law to the questions of civil rights, but rather is that wonderfully heroic prophet of natural rights and of civil rights in our own day. But he relies upon a tradition that was much older. A century before Martin Luther King, Charles H. Langston was convicted by an Ohio court. The year is 1859, and so we are before the Civil War. He was convicted for violating the federal laws at that point that required the return of fugitive slaves. This is one of those incidents that led to our Civil War. In the course of his defense speech, he too invoked a higher law. He did not succeed in his plea before the court. Civil rights at that stage in our history required a very bloody war, and then after the war required amendments. We'll have a chance to look at them later on in the course of our lectures. But listen to his words and hear that doctrine of natural law ring out in the course of what he considered to be the civil rights of individuals where those civil rights were not being respected. He said, "I will do all I can for any man thus seized and held, though the inevitable penalty hang over me." He says, "We all have a common humanity, and you all would do that. Your manhood would require it. And no matter what the laws might be, you would honor yourself for doing it, while your friends and your children, to all generations, would honor you for doing it. And every good and honest man would say you have done right." Notice his reference to a common humanity, his sense that no matter what the law may say, calling the black people of that day who were slaves and therefore property or chattel, nonetheless he recognizes in them a common humanity, and he thinks that this requires that he act, failing to return fugitive slaves, even if it is against the federal law of that day, precisely because there are duties that flow from our common humanity, and he's willing to accept the penalty. This, too, will be an important part of the natural law tradition, the willingness to accept the penalties that civil disobedience incurs, because there is a higher law that must be respected as higher, not because we prefer it, but rather out of a sense that it is superior and supreme. Now, in these examples, what I hope to have shown is that people of very widely different periods of time, in extremely varied circumstances, and even of different background and religious belief, have nonetheless called upon this tradition of a higher law or a natural law. In this course, what I'd like to do is to give philosophical consideration to that idea. Philosophy is a wonderful approach to these questions that we sometimes have an intuitive sense of. We heard in all three of those, especially in Antigone's speech, her intuition that she had to do something for her brother. We heard in Martin Luther King a sense that we have a fundamental humanity which must be respected. But when we find that others disagree with us, we need to make arguments. And so the burden of this course of lectures will be to try to make a philosophical argument. It will be an effort to make those intuitions that we have more rigorous, give them very precise statement, for that is what a large part of what philosophy does. We need to consider ideas that are other than our own, ideas with which we might disagree or agree spontaneously, and we must submit them to rigorous scrutiny, because sometimes the things that we find so evident and so compelling are merely prejudices. And the things that we find a little disagreeable with, perhaps because we sense something uncomfortable about their implications, might actually bear tremendous importance and have effect upon things that we have taken for granted. That there can be tremendous moral progress, even in the course of examining the ideas that we have a spontaneous reaction to, favorable or unfavorable. A second reason for submitting this to philosophical scrutiny, beyond merely the desire to be fair and honest about somebody's idea, a second reason has to do with the institutionalization of these ideas. Namely, we can have ideas, Antigone had them, Martin Luther King had them, the justices at Nuremberg were very deeply having them, but there is a need for the institutionalization of ideas if we want everyone to receive fair treatment by law courts, by administrative officials, by those authorities who are charged with care of the common good. Philosophy, especially the philosophy of natural law, is aimed with considering how to institutionalize those ideas. Some of the obligations of morality will be relatively easy to institutionalize. Laws, for instance, against murder or against theft. Laws which defend our property and our liberty. But other ideas of morality will be extremely difficult to institutionalize. Have you ever thought, for instance, about whether there could be a law that required gratitude? We tell our children from the time when they're knee-high to a grasshopper that they need to say thank you and that they're not doing right if they fail to be grateful for. And yet we wouldn't think of locking somebody up for not being grateful. Some parts of morality can be institutionalized in ways that require sanction, penal sanction if they are violated. Others are things which moral suasion does better at. And hence, a philosophical review is intended to consider these questions. A third reason for turning to a philosophical consideration of natural law is precisely because of the status of natural law ideas in our own legal theory today. Legal theory that is present in most law schools and practiced in most courts goes under the name of positivism. Just a few minutes ago, we talked about those suprapositive ideas that were referred to in the German 1955 decision. Positivism is a broad legal theory which suggests that law and morality have to be kept entirely separate. Perhaps morality can have a role in legislatures, so that if you have moral ideas, whether from a philosophical source or from a religious source, you ought to work with legislatures to try to enact those if you think it appropriate and for the common good. But that courts should stay strictly away from any such reference to morality, and that courts should insist only upon formality, on asking about whether a particular deed does or does not follow under a particular law, and secondly, to ask whether a particular law does or does not fall under the purview of the Constitution. As such, the consideration is purely formal, and in a pluralist society, that may be the best we can do, confining questions of morality to the legislature, and then asking our justices to make a strictly formal consideration of it. On the other hand, something doesn't sit right within us when we have laws that seem to violate our moral convictions. One found that, for instance, in the civil rights cases of last century, when the case of slaves was brought to the court and decided against the slave in the case of Dred Scott. Somehow we found, most of us feel, that there's something dreadfully wrong about that. But it's a question whether or not there should be a moral angle to the judicial review that is practiced by the courts charged with considerations of deeds and of laws. What we will be undertaking then, with a philosophical consideration of the matter, is aiming to bring philosophical scrutiny to these fundamental ideas of justice and a theory of justice. I'll be referring again and again to the following traits: objectivity, universality, and intelligibility, because I think these are philosophical ideals for anything that we try to turn our philosophical acumen to. And when it's a matter of questions of ethics, these will be extremely important. In considerations, for instance, of universality, what we'll be aiming at is some kinds of notion, some kind of theory, some kind of justification that applies to every human being, not just to people of a certain race, not just to people of a certain religion, not just to people of a certain kinship relationship to us, but rather something that is truly universal. Secondly, there will be a concern with objectivity, that is, a desire to have any person who is attempting to make these claims provide the kind of evidence, provide the kind of argument, provide the kind of understanding of the material that will compel, that will seem to be truly coercive, that will seem to be truly strong to another person considering the matter. It won't be just subjective opinion, but rather will have an element of objectivity to it, something that I do not create or control or alter that is the basis of my truth claim. Third, we'll be considering intelligibility, that is, whether or not the notion that I propose or that anyone in the natural law tradition proposes is something that is readily understandable. Some of these things will, I think, strike us as very simple and common. And ethics is generally on sound footing when it starts with cases that are intuitively clear. Murder, for instance, is wrong because it's a matter of taking an innocent life and doing so deliberately. That's an intelligible notion, and we find it readily intelligible that there should be no arbitrary license to kill. But when we turn to things that are much more complicated, things much further in detail, the intelligibility will come only when there is sufficient training. What we'll be attempting to do then in this course is to submit the notion of law, the notion of nature, the notion of human nature, and finally the notion of natural law to philosophical scrutiny in order to try to provide a morality, a theory of ethics that has those characteristics: objectivity, universality, and intelligibility.